Good afternoon. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the session. This is Thinking About Life Insurance Through a Genetic Lens. I'm not sure if you're aware, you're all very privileged to be here, obviously. This session was mentioned in the AFR this morning, page 18 in the AFR. So we've got obviously quite a bit of interest in genetics, and the AFR has picked up on this and written quite a long piece. So well worth them. You're going to be, I guess, in the realm of a hot topic here for sure. So let me introduce my two speakers here. We've got Jessica Chen. Jessica's the Deputy Appointed Actuary leading the Life Insurance Valuation Team at BT. Prior to BT, she worked at TAL. She drove capital initiatives and reporting. And in particular, she implemented the new capital standards. And she's curious in assessing the continuing challenges and opportunities faced by life insurers. And then beside me, we've got Damian Vukovic. Damian is a research fellow at the University of Melbourne and also the Murdoch Children's Research Institute, especially in statistical genetics and biostatistics. He obtained his doctorate at the University of Oxford in 2009, where he was one of the contributors to the seminal Wellcome Trust Care Control Consortium study, published in Nature in 2007. This is the first large-scale genome-wide association survey, and it set the standard for the boom in genetics research that followed, including paving the way for personal genomics companies such as 23andMe and the development of genetic risk scores, which are currently a hot topic of research. Damian's current work focuses on methods to infer immune system gene variants and apply these to disease studies to uncover the biological role of these genes and their contribution to disease risk. I never thought I'd say that sentence before, but I got through it. But this is a really interesting topic. Please, I'll keep questions till the end, and there'll be plenty of time for that. So please give a big round of applause to our two presenters. And sorry, Jess, I had to, before you start, I was supposed to ask a key question, which is, I hope this session will make me think differently.
Right. Thank you. Thank you, Ian, for that introduction. So to begin, I would like to ask you that we know about 1 in 5 of you will be at high risk of developing heart disease. Now, rather than that just being a number, what if you can actually know if you're that one? For the cost of roughly $200 USD, and also you won't have to tell your insurance company. So if that was the case, I bet some of you may consider taking out this test and may even consider to anti-select, possibly. So the purpose of our talk today is to assess whether or not we should think differently about genetics. So in order for us to answer this question, what we did was we obtained a baseline of where the current industry thinks that we are in terms of genetics and whether or not it's a big risk. And then Damian will present on the latest in the genetics research. And then every good actuary will do some sort of analysis. Now, this is very high-level analysis, but we tried to estimate the impact of claims and lapses. And then finally, we put some ideas on how we should think about this in the future. So, current views. Now, based on the industry guidance, the FSC has said, and I take out three key things. The first thing is, if someone's taken out a genetic test, then they have to disclose this information if requested. But that person is not compelled to go and take a genetic test if they haven't already done so. And then if the result of the genetic test is used, it needs to be taken into account with other factors, such as whether or not you've had early screening, your lifestyle choices, etc. And then finally, if that information is then used for the calculation of your premium or whether or not you've been declined cover, then basically you need to provide a reason, or the insurer need to provide a reason to the customer. So this is the guidance. And then based on talking to people within the industry, the feel is currently the underwriting teams don't necessarily always request this information. There could be a few reasons why, and then I'll come and discuss these. But in essence, it's not currently used in assessing outcomes, and based on the literature we've seen, it's reasonably consistent with the practices in the US as well. And so before we began writing our paper, what I did was I went and spoke to a few people, including chief underwriters and chief medical officers, to get their view as to whether or not they think genetics is a real risk. So the four key questions that I asked were, firstly, how deterministic is this information? What will it definitely tell you? And their view was, well, there are some diseases which we know that hasn't shown any symptoms, but that will manifest only later in life. But those diseases are very rare. So Huntington's is one of those, but there's not very many. The next question I then asked was, well, in your opinion, do you think that knowing your genetics information would give you more information than, say, the current underwriting methods, such as gaining family history or blood test results? And their view was not necessarily. They feel as if, well, genetics is mostly hereditary, and so if it is hereditary, then surely you've probably seen some of this through family history. And then I asked, okay, well, even if that is the case, do you actually use these results or can you use these results in your underwriting? And their view is, it's actually hard to use the results of a genetic test because it may be challenged in court. So, for example, if someone's result comes back and then they say that, okay, I have high genetic risk, but then they can also argue that I also have a very healthy lifestyle. So whilst I'm high risk on this, I might be low risk on that, and so overall, I should be considered as an average person. And then the last question I said, well, okay, but is there any evidence of non-disclosure in claims? And based on what I've seen and based on the people I've talked to, there's very few cases of decline based on non-disclosure of genetics information. So based on these key questions, the overall consensus I got before we did any research was, whilst the industry feel like it's an emerging issue, it's not an immediate threat. So now what I'll do is I'm going to pass over to Damien, and he will talk you through the latest in the genetics research.
Thanks, Jess. The risk of disease for any particular individual can depend on lots of different factors. Some of those might be genetic. Some of those might be to do with lifestyle. And so what we're interested in today is the particular genetic aspect. How much of a disease is disease risk depends on genetic factors. Now, there are ways of quantifying this, and we can actually do estimates. So here's some statistics from the field, where for a range of diseases there's a measure called heritability, which is a way of measuring how much the genetic factors contribute to the disease risk. So you can see there's quite a range of values. So for example, at the top we have type 1 diabetes, where this is estimated to be 85%. That means the majority of risk for type 1 diabetes is actually genetic at its foundation. And if you go down the list, you get down to, for example, stroke, where it only accounts for about 15% of the variance. So the influence of genetics varies across diseases, but for many diseases, it's actually quite substantial. So it's certainly of interest to know, certainly from a health point of view, but also from a risk prediction point of view. So the study of genetic factors, so in particular trying to identify specific genetic variants that underlie disease risk, has been going for a few decades. So one of the big milestones was in the 80s, we developed a technique called linkage analysis. And this one looks at families with large numbers of cases of a disease. And by studying the inheritance patterns and looking at the bits of DNA that are inherited throughout the family, we've been able to locate certain genes that affect or that cause that disease. And this sort of technique has been particularly successful for what are called monogenic diseases, so diseases where there's a single gene that controls that disease or the majority of the disease risk. So it's things like Huntington's disease, cystic fibrosis, and many, many others. So this has been a success story for those sorts of diseases. There are many other diseases that aren't like this and that are quite common, things like heart disease, and cancer, diabetes, where there isn't just a single genetic variant that controls the genetic risk, but there's many, many of them. So we call these polygenic diseases. And this sort of technique wasn't very successful for those sorts of diseases. However, in the last decade or so, a different technique has been developed and has become feasible, called a genome-wide association study. So this one involves studying not families, but large numbers of unrelated individuals. And we have ways of measuring the genome. So we measure across the whole genome, and we look for evidence in specific parts of the genome for genetic variants that underlie disease risk. So you'll see plots like these used to summarise such studies. So here on the x-axis, we have basically a position along the genome, and on the y-axis is a measure of evidence of a specific variant having association with the disease risk. And wherever you see a peak here that says, oh, here's a genetic variant where there's strong evidence that it's related to this disease. And what we often see now is studies where we have lots of these peaks, which means lots of discoveries of genetic variants that underlie this disease. So over the last decade or so, this has become the tool of choice for studying common polygenic diseases. And you'll often see articles in the newspapers saying, oh, new discovery of this for this disease or that disease. And in many cases, this is just yet another genome-wide association study. So now we have more than 30,000, getting close to 40,000 discovered variants that underlie risk for one disease or another. So what is this? How does this feed into actually predicting the risk for individuals? So when we talk about genetic testing, at the moment, people who don't work in genetics certainly have a view, this sort of view, where it's centred on monogenic disease. So this is where there's a single gene, and we sort of test for that gene, and then you find out, oh yes, you've got the high risk variant, like you're going to get the disease, or you carry the risk variant, but you won't get the disease. But if you have a child with someone else who's a carrier, you have a chance of getting a disease. So this is the sort of view that's relevant for monogenic diseases. And when you do these sorts of tests, you do it for various reasons. For example, you might use it to confirm a medical diagnosis because the test is quite predictive, like strongly predictive, or in some cases 100%. Or you might want to determine if you're a carrier to help with family planning. So these sorts of tests have been around for a while. People are used to it. The insurance industry is used to this sort of thing. What's the big development in recent times has been this prediction of risk for polygenic diseases based on the findings from these genome-wide association studies. So how does this work? So we do studies like this, and then we find the genetic variants that we have strong evidence for, and then we can use various statistical methods to develop a risk, or what we call a polygenic risk score. So this is a single number that essentially pulls all the information together into a measure of risk for individuals. And this lets you give a distribution of risk across the population. So some people might have a large number of the high-risk variants and might be off on the right tail of distribution, so they have high risk of disease. Some might be low. So we don't. Rather than just having more of a binary view, as in you carry the gene for this disease, you're going to get it or not, it's more of a continuous distribution. And to give you a sense of how fast this field or this how much we've progressed in this research, here's another way of representing this risk distribution for different periods in time. And as time has gone on, we've discovered more and more risk variants. In particular, this graph is for breast cancer risk. So what we have here on the x-axis is basically people ranked in order of risk, and on the y-axis is a measure of risk. So the higher you are here, the stronger your disease risk. So it's in terms of the odds of disease. So if you just had a flat line here, that means, well, we're not getting any information. We're having the same risk estimate for every individual. So the steeper the line is, the more we are differentiating high risk from low risk individuals. So you can see over time, with the lines getting steeper and steeper. So the steepest here is from 2013. You can see off on the right end, we have individuals that have an odds of about 2. On the left, we have odds of about 0.5, which means there's a fourfold difference in risk from the lowest to the highest risk individuals based on this type of genetic risk score. So I'm going to go through one specific disease to give you a flavour for how much what we know about it and how much the research has progressed. And I've picked a disease that's quite important for in terms of health, so coronary artery disease. It's the leading cause of death worldwide. It's also a leading cause of life insurance claims, so very much relevant to our discussion. So what do we know now about risk prediction for coronary artery disease? So I've taken a study that's a year old now. This used a genetic risk score based on 50 discovered genetic variants and used it to have stratified that into three groups, a high risk, a medium, and low risk. So the high risk is the top 20% based on the score. The low risk is the bottom 20%, and intermediate is the rest. So on the left here, we show incidence across lifetime of an individual, incidence of heart disease for these three different groups. So the red, the line at the top, is for the high-risk group. So you can see here that the high-risk group has about twice the number of twice the incidence of coronary artery disease compared to the low-risk group. So this is based purely on a prediction using genetic factors alone. So it's the sort of information you get from birth as opposed to the current lifestyle. As a comparison, the graph on the right does the same sort of thing but looking at lifestyle factors. So here they combine various lifestyle factors together into a lifestyle risk score and similarly stratified into three groups. So this includes things like whether you're a smoker or not, whether you have high blood pressure or not, whether you exercise. So putting all these things together, this is the sort of risk prediction possible, and it's similar to what we can do with genetics. So in other words, for coronary artery disease, the capability of risk prediction using genetics alone is on par with using lifestyle factors alone. And these two are independent pieces of evidence, information. You might think we can combine them together usefully, and indeed we can. So this graph shows you a combination of the three. So the three possible genetics categories, three possible lifestyle categories, gives you nine possibilities all up. So, for example, if you want to compare high genetic risk with low lifestyle risk, that's the group on the right, the blue bar, versus the converse, which is the red bar on the left group, you'll see that the risk, the incidence is about the same for both. So that says, if you're high genetic risk with a good lifestyle, you can sort of compensate for it to a decent extent. And also means for us, we can make useful risk predictions using both pieces of information. Now, an important question in this field is, well, we already know family history. That captures some genetic information, surely. So what use is it to have a genetic test? Well, it turns out that knowing family history is useful. Having a genetic test is also useful. And in fact, they seem to complement each other in that we are getting different pieces of information from both of them. So here's a graph from a study that looked at using both the risk prediction and both helped to increase the accuracy of the prediction. So for example, on the right, if you look at the blue curve and the green curve, the top two, so this represents individuals that were high genetic risk, but the blue one is people with a family history and the green one is without. And the red and the black lines at the bottom are similar, but those are for the low-risk group based on the genetic test, so one with a family history and one without. So it is still useful to have family history, but nevertheless, the genetic test gives you information on top of that. And that's not surprising because with a genetic test, you're actually measuring the genetic variables directly rather than with a family history, you only know partly because you may or may not inherit the risk variants from your parents, for example. So it's important to bear in mind when you're thinking about these tests how they might be used in practice, because this will affect whether or not they get used widely. So one example where this sort of test might end up getting used in a quite widespread sense would be if it gets adopted for screening. So at the moment, suppose you have a medical intervention of some sort, or even like a public health intervention, for example, and you want to promote exercise or better diet. You might target that in a way that's based on age for coronary artery disease because, risk increases with age. So if you target older people, you're going to get more bang for your buck with such a program. If you knew genetic information as well, you could stratify them by genetics and start targeting them at different ages. So here, If we use this risk score, you can see with the red line, which is the high-risk individuals, you should start targeting them early, if we're around age 52, 53. If you want, that's the stage at which that group reaches 10% risk of incidence, whereas if you take the low-risk group, they don't reach that level of risk until they're 70. So if you want to use your budget for medical interventions or public health interventions more wisely, and you have genetic information at your disposal, you can use it in this way to stratify the population and target specific groups at different times. So are these tests already available? So certainly the monogenic tests that we're all familiar with are these predictive style tests based on polygenic scores available too? Yes, they have been available, for example, through companies like 23andMe, which market directly to customers, and you can go online and order a test for $200. They'll send you a kit, and you send them a swab of your saliva, and they'll give you various reports of genetic risk as well as other things. And I expect that this sort of service is only going to get more widespread. So this is where we are with genetics. What does this entail for life insurance? So we're going to show you a high-level analysis where we've looked at the current research, and we're going to try to predict what sort of impact it'll have on life insurance. So a question to ask to start off with is, well, if you take this sort of test, would people actually use it to inform their life insurance decisions? And the answer, we think, is yes. And there's some evidence in the literature. For example, there's a study that looked at long-term care insurance in the US and Alzheimer's disease and showed that people who knew they were high risk based on a genetic test were more likely to take out insurance. So that means we can move on to the next question. Is now, you know, we know that this is going to be, this will make, have an impact. How can we assess it? So what we're going to show you now is a model where we looked at trauma insurance specifically and tried to model the anti-selection effects of having a genetic test. As I said, we're going to use the latest genetic knowledge based on, for example, the coronary artery disease results I just showed you. And we're going to estimate the cost increase in claim costs and lapse rates that result from this. So we're just going to go through some of the assumptions in our analysis first, and then we'll show you the results. In terms of the genetic assumptions, we've looked at three diseases. So coronary artery disease, which is the one I just showed you, breast cancer, and prostate cancer. So we focused on these mainly because they affect a large proportion of insurance claims. And also, these ones have fairly mature research in terms of genetics and the development of risk prediction. So the stats here are just summaries of based on the current knowledge. So the proportion with high genetic risk is based on a particular grouping of people into high and low risk just for the purpose of modelling. And the increase in risk is we've got from the literature based on the current polygenic risk scores. The proportion of trauma claims comes from stats in the insurance field. So for ease of modelling, we've combined all of these three and treating them as three diseases and treating them as one group. So we say someone is of high genetic risk if they're at high genetic risk for any one of these. So we think of that as one group, and then there's everyone else who are low risk for all of the diseases. We also considered including a few other diseases which also lead to a large number of insurance claims, but we thought that the genetic research wasn't mature enough to be included here, so not enough discoveries yet. So we've gone with just the three at the top. So I'm going to pass it back to Jess now to talk about the other assumptions in our model.
Thanks, Damien. So together with the genetic assumptions, we've also made some very high-level assumptions around life insurance. So, for example, we've said that we've assumed currently only 0.5% of the population are taking out this genetic test. We couldn't find any literature to substantiate this number, but we would be very surprised if it was higher than this. Also, we know that roughly about 8% of the insurable population has trauma. We've assumed that if someone has trauma insurance and then they go out and get a genetic test and find that they are of low risk, then their probability of lapse is 20% compared to a best estimate of, say, 15%. So essentially we're saying that the perceived value of insurance reduces. In addition, we've assumed that everyone who doesn't have insurance at the moment but then would consider taking a genetic test would apply for life insurance in advance of this. Whilst this is quite an extreme assumption, they can technically apply for life insurance after they've gotten a test, and at the moment, because it's a direct consumer model, it will be very hard to prove if they choose not to disclose. So in this example, we're looking at the increase in claims from people who currently don't have insurance, and I'll just step you through how we've modelled this. So we start assuming that there's 100 people in the insurable population, and then we know that of that 92% are currently not insured, so there's 92 of those left. And then we say that of those 92 people, 0.5% take out insurance, and that leaves you 0.5 of a person. And then based on that, 80% of those would find that they are of high risk, and that's 0.1 of a person. And then we say that of these, 100% of these will apply and get trauma insurance. And so then, based on that, we've then done a relative cost of claim. So basically, we've assumed that people who are non-high risk, their cost of claim is a baseline 100%. But then people that are of high risk, it's 111%. So how we got that was we said it's 1 plus 31%, which is the statistic Damien showed you, which is a relative increase in claims due to those three diseases, multiplied by 34%, which is the proportion of trauma claims that are due to heart disease, prostate cancer, and breast cancer. So then we calculate an increase in cost of claims of 0.2. Now, this is not a big number, and the reason why this is not a big number is if you go through and look at the sort of the red train, you'll see that the numbers are reducing really quickly, and mainly it's due to the assumption whereby only 0.5% of the population is taking this test. So it's gone from 92 all the way down to 0.5 really quickly. And then next, then, we look at the potential increase in enforced lapse. So again, we start with 100 people, and then we say that 8 of those have insurance, and then 0.5% go and take out a test, and then 72% of those will find that they are of low risk, so that's 0.03 of a person. And then we say of those, 20% of those will then decide to lapse, and then we find that there is a 0.1% increase in lapse rate, and if you divide that by 15%, which is the best estimate lapse assumption we've assumed, that's a 0.5% increase in lapse rate. Now, that, again, is a small number, and it's predominantly driven by the assumption that only a very small percentage of the population is taking this test. And so then we thought, OK, well, let's have a look at it, at the result, if we do vary this variable. So then we see that, OK, at 0.5%, the current assumption that it's not a large threat still holds. But if we were to increase this and, say, assumed 2 or 5% of the population were to get this test, then we do see that the claim costs and also the increase in lapse rates would be rather material. So then we think that that is the point at which insurers should take notice. So what does this all mean? Now, what we've done here is, in my earlier slide, I showed you where current thinking is, but now we're going to reassess these questions based on the knowledge that we've gained. So the first question is, how deterministic is this information? So based on what Damien said, we know that given the recent advances, the information is now quite useful. And so, therefore, based on these polygenetic scores, we actually know that genetics is quite useful to show for common diseases. And does this give more information than family history? Yes, because we see that it's complementary to each other. So you want to know this as well as your family history. In addition, we say, okay, can this information then be used in underwriting? Now, we think that if the test were to be more widely used, then the answer would be yes, because people could perceive this as similar to a blood test, you know, in which case currently we use blood tests in our underwriting standards. And then finally, have there been cases of declines due to this? Very few, and it could still stay at very low numbers because it's hard to prove non-disclosure through these direct-to-consumer business models. Also, we looked at some longer-term considerations. So the first thing is we're all aware that there will always be an ethical tension between inclusion of people and giving them insurance versus whether or not it would be sustainable for our industry. The second thing is we know that the technology is upon us, and so therefore our industry has to evolve. So that there might be three possible long-term states that we'll get to. The first one is perhaps we'll have more tailored premiums. So based on an individual, we might be able to have a much smaller risk pool. The second extreme is perhaps there will be restrictions. So similar to the health insurance industry, where my premium is the same as my mother's premium, it could be that we're not allowed to use any rating factors. Or we could get to some sort of a middle ground whereby, say, similar to the UK system, where they can't use gender, for example, maybe the government will say that we can't use genetic information. I think that what we want to illustrate is, as an industry, we need to consider how we want to shape our long-term state and what is this long-term state that we want to get to. Now, as a topic of interest, of late there's a lot of media discussion around whether or not group insurance should be opt-in and opt-out or opt-out. This will be interesting given this genetic lens, because if we were to move to an opt-in model, then the impact for anti-selection will be bigger for group insurance. So, in summary, we have two key takeaways. The first thing is the technology is developing, and if it becomes more widely adopted, then we think that it will have a material impact for our industry. And then the second thing is we should start thinking about how we should evolve to be able to adapt to this. So now I'll open up for discussions and any questions. We also have written a paper, so if you do want to read more about it, it's on the Institute website. Thank you.
Thank you, Jess. Thank you, Damien. I concur completely with what Jess says. There is a really good paper that accompanies this. It's well worth a read. It's got obviously a lot more detail than you've seen here today, and it's well worth reading. I guess from my point of view, I challenge you to think differently. One bit I hadn't picked up on was the trend in how good we are getting, or how much better we're getting at, identifying the risk. The link between the risk and the genetic score is great. I mean, that's every 2 years. It seems to be getting steeper and steeper, that curve. That's probably the first kind of thing maybe to ponder over, and feel free to answer, is does that keep going, or does it reach a plateau at some stage whereby, or does it speed up? It seems that the more we know and the more things emerge, then the more things change in this field. Maybe open up to questions. First of all, feel free to come and use the microphone. Please just state your name for the recording, and feel free to step forward.
Hi, Mike Ashley, KPMG. First of all, thanks for a very thought-provoking and interesting presentation. One point that immediately jumped out at me was the fact that in addition to the family information, that if you were to just take genetic information alone, that plus family information was more valuable from an information theoretic sense than just having the genetic information alone. And that tends to imply one of the other things that you put up, which was about one's environment as well as what the hand that one has been dealt genetically. Do you have any comments about that? Is this an example of environment in addition to genetics?
Yes, that's exactly right. So family history captures a lot of different pieces of information, an important one of which is the shared environment between family members. So yes, you've pretty much answered the question. There's another aspect, which is our genetic risk scores, we can only put in there what we discover. we haven't discovered all the genetic factors. So family history will capture other genetic factors that aren't there that that are inherited. So there's that extra piece of information as well. So yeah, shared environment and undiscovered genetics and any interactions between these as well. That family history will be able to capture all of those.
If I could also just make two comments. So that would put a natural limit on the steepness of that curve based on what function of this is environment versus the genetic hand. So the epigenetic part of whether one's lifestyle as maybe dictated by one's family, the environment, so, you can imagine many ways that that could then express those things, that that could actually affect that outcome. The other comment I was going to make is perhaps an aspirational one, and that is that maybe the way that the insurance industry could work is to use this in conjunction with medicine, so that then one could always see that this information is being used for the benefit of the populace. So, for example, if you could, through premium tailing or the like, use that information in order to promote and say to people that you can access this insurance, but you have to work hard at your own health in order to do that and make sensible choices, that would be a very valuable thing, including for government.
I'll just comment on that as well. You're right, there is a natural limit to how predictable a genetic-only test will be, and we can even estimate the limit of that. That's what the heritabilities that I presented are. So we can tell which diseases will only ever be able to have only a modest amount of predictability versus ones where we expect to be able to produce estimates of risk that are most of the way there. And in terms of working in medicine, the one application I showed you where was about targeted, or rather stratified, screening programs that are stratified based on genetics. So that will be a medical application. So if that sort of application drives widespread genetic testing, there's a natural way to hook into that as an insurance industry. And I might let Jess comment on that too.
Yeah, what I was going to say was also for genetics, there's a key difference between the results of those tests versus a blood test, because with your genetics it doesn't change. So actually you would only need to take one test, and you can argue that the information that one test will give you may increase over time as we understand genetics more, whereas other screening tests we use actually changes over time, and so therefore you need to take the test again and again. So if in the future, if this becomes a screening tool and then we were to be able to use this information, then it will be quite powerful.
Hi, Darren Stevens from Premier Solutions. Firstly, thank you very much. Fantastic paper. It's a topic that's dear to my heart. I wrote a blog on this about 18 months ago, very similar to this. And picking up on your point, it followed on from an experience I had with the insurance industry, where my wife, being very diligent, sent me on a complete medical test, and it picked up a couple of things that I needed to fix in my life. About a year later, I went to apply for insurance cover and got declined for that insurance cover. And it wasn't until I sat down with a couple of CMOs, who I know, that I was able to convince them that it was the wrong decision, and that I didn't need to actually get covered, because what I'd done out of the back of those tests was change my lifestyle. And so, in your modelling, did you take into any account people weren't just anti-selecting, they were actually doing things that were going to improve their insurability, that would have just gone by the wayside? I look at depression as an example of that. People that seek treatment for depression are often better off longer term than people who don't. So I take up your point, which this could be a really positive thing for the industry to look to help people when they get picked up for these diseases.
Yeah, thanks for your comment. So in our modelling, it was very simple. And so we looked at the cost as opposed to potential benefits. It is quite difficult to model this because there's so many interactions between variables, and we just haven't considered that in this instance. But thank you for your thought. Any other questions? I might just pass it on to Damien for one comment. comment.
Okay, I was just going to suggest to Jess, you mentioned the AIA Vitality product, which she told me about a few months ago. So when I was looking around for life insurance, I was looking at different products, and I thought, oh, this is interesting. So AIA Vitality, based on me as not someone in the field, but someone as a potential customer, so they have a scheme which is sort of like frequent flyers or something. You build up points based on good behaviours, like getting a medical test or getting a diet sort of assessment. So things that are meant to help you promote positive lifestyle, and then you can use this to, maybe buy a new fancy electronics device or get discounts on your premium. So just like any other point scheme, like a loyalty scheme, it seemed interesting to me because you're not getting money based on spending money. So you're not getting points based on spending money, but you're getting points based on improving your lifestyle. And this was led by an insurance company. So this sort of, this might be a prototype for a sort of scheme that you mentioned where you're trying to help customers improve their lifestyle and therefore reduce risk. So that sort of program sounds great to me. I hope that it gets more widely developed and adopted.
So no last questions? No? Okay. Just a reminder, please give feedback on the app for this. Definitely worth reading the paper. And then please just show your appreciation for our two speakers here.